WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour is made in the air near a fossil fuel power plant. When we burn fossil fuels, we produce waste carbon dioxide. And you probably know that carbon dioxide has a significant impact on climate change and warming. The question becomes then, what can we do about that? Long-term goal is to move our energy infrastructure away from fossil fuels, eventually entirely, but that could take many more decades still. And in the meantime, we are burning fossil fuels and looking for ways to do it more cleanly. Well, this is our monthly Science Roundtable, and we're going to focus on one idea that might help here. It might. It's carbon capture and storage. It's the process of capturing carbon dioxide from fossil fuel power plants and transporting it to a storage site where it will not re-enter the atmosphere. But wait a minute, can you really just separate CO2 and then send it to some underground facility or some other storage site or method? Does it work? Are there negative consequences to that? Where is the technology now? I've got a couple of guests who are going to help answer my questions and yours this hour, and let me go ahead and welcome them now. Bill Jones is here, professor of chemistry at the University of Rochester and associate editor of the Journal of the American Chemical Society. Bill, welcome.
Thank you.
And Richard Eisenberg's here, Professor Emeritus of Chemistry at the University of Rochester, Editor-in-Chief for Inorganic Chemistry. Richard, welcome to you.
Thanks.
Well, let me just start with a question on what this is, because it makes me hopeful to hear that maybe we can do this. Maybe this will mitigate some of the impacts or slow down or even stop the negative consequences for our environment as we use fossil fuels. So let me just ask both of you, and I'll ask you to kind of start, work us through what climate climate capture. It's carbon capture, CCS, carbon capture and storage. What is it?
Well, the real issue is as we produce carbon dioxide from burning fossil fuels, both for power generation and also for automobile, for transportation, the portion of the atmosphere that is made up of carbon dioxide has increased substantially. It's up over 400 ppm now, and it's continuing to rise. So one of the goals, I think, of carbon capture, carbon sequestration, is let's try to stop that increase first. And one way to do that, that's pretty obvious, is to take our biggest sources of carbon that are stationary, carbon dioxide production, say a power plant, and try to capture that CO2 as it comes out of the smokestack. Don't let it go into the atmosphere. Try to decrease this rate of increase of carbon dioxide in air.
How long have we been trying to do this?
I think probably we've been trying in demonstration-type projects for well over a decade, decade and a half, perhaps even longer than that. And these are projects that have been as I said, demonstration projects where you capture CO2 and then you try to put significant amounts of the CO2 into some storage area, the most common one being underground.
Okay. And so before we get there to how that works, because I have all kinds of dumb questions about that, I look at that and I think, wow, how does that work? And does it stay there in perpetuity? Are there possible impacts? But before we even get there, some may wonder, is carbon capture something that would allow us to continue burning fossil fuels with much lesser consequence? In other words, if this works and if this is a scalable thing, can we just stay with fossil fuels? Is it party time for the fossil fuel industry and we can just stay with it?
Well, I'd say that we can't accept the fact that if we go to carbon sequestration, that we would then be able to continue to do what we do. So carbon sequestration falls under the category of climate engineering. These are big scalable projects, as opposed to climate change mitigation, which means let's go to solar or let's go to wind power or other sources that do not have the problems that burning fossil fuels do.
Is climate engineering something that we should be comfortable or uncomfortable with?
Personally, I'm very uncomfortable with that because of the scale that we're talking about. And even though we seem to be clever guys or people in science and engineering, we're not smart enough to figure out all the ramifications that will happen if we store huge amounts of carbon dioxide in subterranean locations.
Well, before I turn back to Bill, let me just press on that then. You know, this kind of engineering, it almost seems like feel like there's a potentially unethical or maybe at least maybe we don't have the knowledge to have the confidence that what we're doing is safe or wise? I mean, is it ethics? Is it sort of a lack of knowledge of consequence? How would you frame it?
I think it's a question of both, but let me let Bill talk to that.
Bill, sure. How do you feel about it?
Yeah, I do think that they are exploring this as a real possibility because it's a place where they could handle the magnitude of the problem. That is, with so much CO2 being produced, you know, you can't just say, oh, we're going to build a tank and put it into some kind of a tank. It's too big of a problem for that. So the idea of pushing it underground offers you immense resource in terms of where you can put CO2. And I think the idea is that the CO2 will go into the ground, but then will mineralize. So it'll become a carbonate, a solid form, rather than a gaseous form.
All right. So can you walk us through how it sort of looks, this process? Because we're talking about, again, burning fossil fuels, the production of carbon dioxide, separating and capturing the carbon dioxide, taking it in a liquid form then? A liquid form?
If it's under pressure, it can become a liquid.
All right. So liquid form, then getting it underground into some kind of a storage, and then I've got questions on what the storage is and if it stays there. But let's just take it step by step. Fossil fuel burning plant happens. Carbon dioxide is emitted. How do you separate? How do you capture the CO2? How does that happen?
So one way it can be done is cryogenically. That is, with lower temperatures, you can actually freeze the CO2 out in the form of ice. And so that would be one way to get it. It's very energy intensive. As a matter of fact, all of these proposed ideas are energy intensive.
Wait, hold on.
You use energy to capture the CO2.
Wait, to save us, we have to kill ourselves? Is that what you're...
Well, this is part of the problem, is you cannot use more energy to capture the CO2 than you're producing by burning the fossil fuel. So the source of that energy has to be considered in this whole cycle.
Okay.
Otherwise, you're...
It's a waste of time.
It's what they call not carbon neutral.
Yeah.
You produce more carbon than you sequester.
Okay. But in an ideal world, you can separate out the CO2 in the form, I guess in the form of ice is one way. It's not the only way?
It's not the only way.
Okay.
So another way to do this is to capture it with a base. So a simplest solution would be a hydroxide solution. When carbon dioxide is bubbled through that solution, it becomes a different chemical, carbonate, and that can be precipitated out as a solid. You've seen the White Cliffs of Dover.
Yeah.
They're all carbonate, okay? So where did that come from? Was that originally CO2 that was in the geology converted into the calcium carbonate that we see today? And I think that's part of this, the whole chemistry, the geochemistry of pumping the CO2 underground is to monitor and measure and determine what happens to the geochemistry underground.
Okay, all right, but hold on. Before we get underground, because I'm getting there.
Yeah.
So now that you've separated this, talk about ignorant questions, but let's just take a regular fossil fuel burning power plant. How much carbon dioxide are we talking about? In other words, how much production of actual some form of CO2 or captured carbon are we talking about here?
Well, let me say that, just 2013, the amount of CO2 that was emitted globally was 35 billion tons. So it's really a large-scale problem globally. And, if you get the CO2 and you are able to capture it, it would make most sense to try and do it out of a power plant because there you have the largest concentration of CO2.
Yep.
If we tried to get it out of the air, even though CO2 levels are really high now compared to what they've been, it's still 400 parts per million in terms of what we have in the air. Most of it is oxygen and nitrogen, and only 400 parts per million corresponds to CO2. So it would take a lot of energy in terms of separations to be able to capture CO2 from the atmosphere.
Richard, you're saying 400 parts per million in the general atmosphere.
That's right.
But near the power plants here.
Much higher.
Much higher concentration.
That's right.
Okay, so much higher concentration. That's essentially the source of a lot of our CO2. We can get at it. 35 billion tons a year, maybe, of CO2. And then you turn that into some kind of a form, maybe ice, maybe others, as we've said. But does that, if you can do that there, does it Does it come into the form of a tube of a pipeline of some kind, or where would it go if you're doing it there?
Sure, I think it would be most probably handled as a gas.
Okay,
and
as a gas.
And then the gas could go into a compressor that would be used to force it down underground with some subterranean pipes going down some distance.
So you are forcing pure CO2.
Or nearly pure.
Nearly pure.
Right.
Underground, mm-hmm. and then compressing it underground?
Well, no, the compressor would do the job above ground.
Got it.
And that would force it down.
You're both so patient with me. This is really, really, really kind of you. No, I'm totally fascinated by this. So, okay, so now it's going underground. And when I was reading the various sources about the idea of carbon capture, what I just could not get my head around was this idea that you put it underground and the idea that it's stored there so it stays out of the atmosphere. Didn't we make the same promise about landfills and groundwater and those kind of – are we able to store it in a way that keeps it there in, for lack of a better term, perpetuity or something close to that?
Well, this is the problem that one has with climate engineering and climate engineering related to CO2 sequestration. So it really raises the issue – if you've put it down there and you expect it to be in perpetuity, will it underground, will it stay there that way? Will there be effects that lead to, for example, any kind of geological disruptions, fracturing of rocks, permeation by water, if there is? And water will combine with CO2, although slowly, and form carbonic acid, which is the related to carbonates. And if you form carbonates, that's fine. But if you don't, what else is happening? You have to have ions to be able to form the minerals with carbonate. So there are lots of questions, and we don't know the answers to all of these. I'm just struck by the fact that, let's say, in Oklahoma, just from fracking, they've had more earthquake disturbances. I don't know what would happen by putting large amounts under pressure of CO2 into land.
Okay. So as we talked to Richard and Bill about carbon capture and storage as it relates to climate change there, what is the worst case scenario that you see, Richard? In other words, when it's underground, if we did this on a larger scale, what to you are the sort of the darkest scenarios that you could see happening?
Well, I think from my standpoint, people may take that as equivalent to climate change mitigation and therefore move away from the urgency that we have to really move ourselves into a carbon-free energy future. And that, to me, is the biggest challenge right now.
This is the get out of stop using fossil fuels free card. This would be the excuse people have to say, well, we're taking carbon out of the atmosphere, right?
That's right.
And when we've heard that before. We've heard callers say on this program, we talk about climate change, isn't there something we could do to take carbon out of the atmosphere? That's essentially what we're talking about this hour.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of container underground would be constructed, is being constructed for this kind of thing? What is the container like?
I'm not sure it's an actual container. It may just be fractures in the terrain itself. I mean, just this last week, the DOE announced $11 million in funding. And if you look at what projects they're funding, they are almost all geothermal people. These are people that work and study what happens under the earth, under the surface of the earth. They want to map out permeability of different rock formations. How can you monitor and tell that the CO2 that you put down in there is staying there? Can you monitor fault zones to see how they're changing over time? Get real-time analysis. That means as you're doing the pumping, what's going on under the surface to change the structure, the geology. And they are funding basic research in this area. So I'd say a lot of the answers we don't know, but there is potential, as we've seen, for a change in the structure under the earth that can result in consequences on the surface.
Okay, let me get our first phone call, and this is Keith. First up in our monthly science roundtable. Go ahead, Keith.
Evan, an interesting show. A quick question, or a comment. First, a comment. I don't think storing it underground is really good because eventually, as tectonic plates move, now we're talking probably millions and not billions of years, it's going to be released. But what about artificial photosynthesis? How much has been done on that? Because when you think about it, you take a little sunlight and a little CO2, and you can feed plants.
All right, stay here,
they
Keith.
Turn it into sugar and oxygen.
Let's let them start with that. Stay here, Keith. Go ahead, guys.
I think it's a wonderful question, and there are different aspects with regard to photosynthesis, natural and artificial. I happen to work in research related to artificial photosynthesis. So in natural photosynthesis, you take carbon dioxide and water, and both of these molecules are incredibly stable. They're really the end products of oxidation from carbohydrates or from fuels that we burn, from methane, from coal. We get carbon dioxide and water. And then if we want to use those two molecules to make stored chemical energy, we need to put energy in, such as from the sun. For natural photosynthesis, we make carbohydrates. For artificial photosynthesis, which might just use water, we can split water into hydrogen and oxygen, and hydrogen becomes the fuel. That's a carbon-free future that I personally subscribe to and hope that we can move forward in that direction. Now, we do have research going on at a number of different levels with regard to moving for a hydrogen or a liquid oxygenate, meaning alcohol, type future. And I hope that the research is translated into actual practice in the near future. We are starting to see fuel cell cars in California. The number of hydrogen fueling stations has increased and will hit 50 this year in the state of California. That's from 15 just 2 years ago and zero a couple of years before that. There are hydrogen fuel cell cars in a number of different countries that are being tested, and these are made by the regular car manufacturers.
Okay. Keith, you want to follow up there?
Well, I basically understood what your guest is trying to talk about, but what I'm thinking about is an artificial leaf, but something that does it on mass quantities. Because, correct me if I'm wrong, photosynthesis takes place in leaves. Could that be artificially made so you have massive panels that all it does is convert CO2 into, I think you said carbohydrates, and oxygen?
All right, thank you, Keith. Go ahead, guys.
Well, there actually are some researchers that are claiming to have made an artificial leaf. In fact, what it does is it takes water and splits it into hydrogen and oxygen. So it's not quite the same thing. We don't take CO2 into account as part of the chemistry. But once you have the hydrogen produced and it's from a solar source, hydrogen is valuable as energy. Remember I talked about you need energy if you're going to pump CO2 into the ground? Well, you also need energy if you want to take CO2 and convert it chemically into a liquid fuel. Now you would have a way to use sunlight to make hydrogen, use the hydrogen to convert CO2 into a liquid fuel. Now you don't need gasoline. We've removed that from the carbon cycle. So that's the vision that's out there. That's for the future. We're not close to that yet, but that's the vision that's out there. And I'd say definite progress has been made in the last decade to produce hydrogen from water using sunlight. And that's one of the first steps, I think, in getting out of this ball and chain that we have locked to fossil fuels.
We're talking to Bill Jones and Richard Eisenberg from the University of Rochester about this question on, well, the ball and chain, as Bill put it. I think that's an interesting way of putting it. Climate change and carbon capture and storage and whether it's scalable and doable and whether we'll have the impact we hope as we eventually move to bring down our usage of fossil fuels and scale up other things. But on the question of scale, gentlemen, let me ask both of you. I mean, I know you care deeply about these matters and the question on how the industry will change eventually. What's a realistic time for when we don't have gas stations on the corners, when we can power our vehicles, whatever it looks like, power our transportation, and we have scaled up something else enough. And it doesn't have to be just one thing. This is, I think, an interesting part of the conversation is, do we have to have one thing replace fossil fuels? Does it have to be solar or just wind? I think it may be a mixed bag, but the question is, will we have enough of the mixed bag to scale up and replace it? When? I'll start with you, Richard.
Well, I think it's very difficult to predict, but I do think we need a disruptive technology, to use the phrase, and that's one that will cause us to change really how we live. With regard to cars, electric cars and fuel cell cars are competing technology right now in terms of zero emission vehicles. For the electric cars, it is a question, where will the electricity come from? If it comes from a coal-fired power plant, that's a problem. If it comes from a wind-generated power plant, then I think you have something that becomes carbon-free. The same thing with regard to creation of hydrogen from the electrolysis of water. If, in fact, the energy comes from the sun, is captured by photovoltaics, or you have some other type of system, it is, as I said, would be a disruptive technology. Now, where are we in this? We have a lot of the science in that has been done, but we have not moved yet to fully commercialize our ability to make hydrogen or except for maybe Elon Musk with regard to batteries. But again, the question comes back, where's the electricity coming from?
Senator Eisenberg, I need a year. You avoided the question, sir. No, I'm mostly kidding. But, you know, I think you make a lot of
good points. That's absolutely right. That's absolutely right.
But what's realistic? I mean, 10 years is probably not realistic. Is 15, is 20, is 25?
I think there will be a long period. This is, if you will, what other disruptive technologies have we had? And over the last couple of decades, the web, for example.
Yep.
And it's been a very fast one. But here you're talking about something that relates to the infrastructure of the company, of the country, how we go from one place to another, how we move products, how we heat our homes. So it's a much, much more difficult problem. And I think that there will be a significant shift within 10 to 15 years, but we will still be burning some fossil fuels. We're going to for at least 30, 40, 50 years.
Okay.
I agree completely. I mean, we only recently discovered all of the shale gas, the methane, and that's dominated now the U.S. energy picture. China will be mainly an energy picture derived from coal. Europe will be more petroleum-based. So already the world is dividing up in terms of how it's, what fossil fuels it's going to be using in the future. So I think this technology needs to be developed. It's going to take 20 or 30 years to develop the technology.
We're talking carbon capture now.
Carbon capture and conversion to some useful fuel form, it's going to be at least 20 or 30 years away.
Well, you bring up China. This is an interesting point because sometimes we get a little myopic and we think about what are we doing, what can we do to change. Obviously, in a global world, there are so many complex parts of this, because if China and India don't want to get on board, there's pressure on big economic systems to, you know, sort of feel like, can we do this without hurting our economy? And obviously, that's one of the big debates going on. And listen, I am not sitting here saying that if we convert away from fossil fuels, it'll crush the economy. But I understand those who are worried about that. That's all I'm saying. So when you look at China, you say China is probably going to be with coal for a long time. Is there any indication that China is interested in these kind of technologies?
Actually, let me say that China is probably producing more solar panels right now and putting them into play. You're talking about essentially the growth of a country which depends on coal, but also is able to put its engineering into production of other sources of energy, and photovoltaics is one of those.
Okay, Bill?
Yeah, and the other thing to remember, I mean, China has developed so rapidly, so quickly, air pollution has become a major problem in almost every major Chinese city. And the cities over there have millions of people. They're all huge. They recognize that with all the adverse health effects of pollution, they need to do something about it, and they need to do something quickly. So I think they may be convinced to take on the CO2 problem basically overnight once they decide it's a priority.
Interesting. A listener named Phil writes and says, Evan, maybe I'm hearing it wrong, but your guests seem very opposed to this process of carbon capture. Is there anything that could make it better in their eyes? Is Phil missing the point, a concern about carbon capture?
Well, I'm a little pessimistic about its practical application. Is it going to be, if it's not cost effective, it's not going to be taken up by the industry. I'm not sure if the government will take on regulating it. EPA is under fire as it is. I can't imagine that they're going to put new requirements in that companies must pump their CO2 underground. So I'm pessimistic because of that issue. Practically, it may indeed be possible to do it, and it may indeed be safe to do it. We don't know yet.
Okay. Richard?
Well, I would tend to agree with Bill. And I just, as I said earlier, it's a question of, are you taking your eye off the ball? If you think that carbon capture and sequestration is the answer to our climate change problem, then I think you've lost the whole point of this, which is really that we need to move to a carbon-free energy future.
Okay, so maybe a listener like Phil, I think his name is Phil, yes, Phil, would think, well, can't we chew gum and walk at the same time, Richard? Can't we capture carbon while we're still using fossil fuels on our way to a much more diverse energy future?
I think the answer is yes, you could. But I also think that because of, let's say, the established industries, and this is the entire petroleum, power generating industries, that there is going to be pushback to change in the wholesale way that we would need to in order to get to a carbon-free energy future. And anything that they can do to postpone it, such as carbon capture and sequestration, they may be in favor of. And yet at the same time, I think it takes your attention away from the really long-term problem.
Got a number of listener questions coming in here. Here's Rick sending an email saying, don't fool yourselves. It has taken hundreds of years to get our fossil fuel system and infrastructure in place. It will not be replaced in 10 to 15 years. That's from Rick. And Bill, you're nodding right along with that.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that statement, except let me point out one place that might make him pause. When you go to the gas pump today and pump gasoline, you'll notice a sticker that says 10% ethanol.
Yeah.
That ethanol came, as you know, from biosources. That was grown fuel. So I wouldn't be so quick. But I agree, we're not going to just replace all this infrastructure quickly.
How good of an idea was ethanol? Well, that's a whole other conversation.
Right.
But the bottom line is that did enter the infrastructure pretty quickly once we decided it was a priority. So it's a question of priority. I'm just going to ask the questions as they come. Here's John writing to us on carbon dioxide sequestration. If you turn CO2 into carbonate mineral underground, won't the process self-clog and stop further admission of CO2?
I think the answer is probably yes. Hmm. Yes. That is, if you have let's suppose underground there's a cavern of water that's basic and it will absorb CO2 and make a mineral, then eventually you're going to just can replace the water with the solid carbonates.
Okay. And John on Twitter, does the technology exist to capture CO2 directly at the source? For example, a device on a tailpipe or right on a smokestack? And what are the hurdles for that?
So the current capture materials are solids, polymers that have amines attached to them. And again, this is a way to capture CO2 now as a carbamate instead of a carbonate. It's a different chemical. But then that can be heated up and it releases the CO2 at a different place. So that's one of the current technologies that you could use on, say, to carry around with your car. Now imagine you have a device much larger than your gas tank to capture everything that's being burnt as it comes out. That's what this might look like. So it would be rather unwieldy. I'm not sure that people would want to put up with it.
But it wouldn't be hanging off the edge of smokestacks, right? Or what would it look like, I guess? I'm trying to picture it.
It could be a giant filter on the exhaust pipe on the way out of the car.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So that's all part of the process here. I lost track of time. I'm late for a break. Let's get our only break of the hour. And we're going to come back with our guests as we talk in our monthly science roundtable about carbon capture and storage. And we'll continue to answer your questions about this. We're talking about our energy usage and demands. Had a question from a listener about just how much carbon, how much fossil fuels are we actually using now? And we've got some numbers on that. I think I actually stole them from these guys. So I think we're going to go over what we can tell you about current fossil fuel usage. Maybe they're from my research. Bill, you're looking at me shaking your head. I thought I had some from you. They might be from our research. Producer Megan Mack, of course, probably doing a lot of great research as well. But we'll try to answer your questions on how much we're using fossil fuels, what some of the projections are, and more about possible alternatives. It's all part of the discussion. You can call toll-free if you want to weigh in, 844-295-TALK. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Short break, and we're right back. I'm Evan Dawson, Tuesday on The Next Connections. It's one thing to live in the suburbs and say you care about the city of Rochester. It's another to decide you're going to walk every single street in the city, see it up close, and get to know it. That's what one woman did. We'll talk to her about what she learned from that experience. Then second hour, the Landmark Society wants to identify landmarks of significance to the LGBTQ community. Talk to you Tuesday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, Bill Jones, and Richard Eisenberg here, professors at the University of Rochester. Bill, professor of chemistry at the University of Rochester and associate editor for the Journal of the American Chemical Society. And we have a professor emeritus of chemistry at the University of Rochester, an editor-in-chief for inorganic chemistry. And I'm just going to keep working through some of your questions. I know they want to weigh in as well about some of the subjects that have already come up. We're going to continue to talk about carbon, the different forms of energy, what's cleaner than not. And I guess where I'll start is this. During our brief break, we were talking a little bit about carbon, methane, other questions. Sometimes when we talk about energy, we hear people talk about fossil fuels versus everything else, and they kind of group together. I mean, I lived and worked in West Virginia. I had a chance to see. I covered the coal industry very, very closely for the first part of my career, and it was very eye-opening for me, both what you're able to get out of the ground, but also the cost to do it, the human cost sometimes, the cost to communities. So you've got coal. You obviously have different forms of energy, but having worked in West Virginia myself, I chafe a little bit at the notion that all forms are exactly equal in terms of cost, environmental cost, and everything else that goes with it. Do you feel the same? I mean, do you prioritize one worse than another when it comes to fossil fuels?
Well, yeah, there's no question that natural gas, methane, for example, has the formula CH4. It has more hydrogen than any other carbon-containing fuel. And as a consequence, it has the least amount of CO2 generated per unit of heat that we get from burning it. So methane is a wonderful bridge fuel to the future of a carbon-free
environment. Now, Richard, you know, if you use the word bridge fuel on the air, it turns the rest of the hour into a conversation about fracking. It's magic. It's amazing. It's just you can't stop it. It's an avalanche. I don't mean to be flip, but I mean people hear gas.
Absolutely,
they hear
frack
gas as a bridge fuel, and some say we can't even afford a bridge fuel. We need much more urgency and prioritization now. I suspect you're someone who wants to see even more priority. You know, if you've just joined us here, part of what he's been talking about all hour is, even if we can successfully capture carbon, there is a risk there that it takes our eye off the ball, which is eventually getting away from carbon entirely. So, but anyway, I just wanted to interject there that you may get some feedback on the question of bridge fuels, whether they exist or
not. That's a legitimate point, and I agree. I agree with that. But coal is, in many ways, the worst because it has the least amount of hydrogen and therefore the most carbon dioxide that gets generated per unit heat that you obtained from the fuel. So these are important things to consider going forward. Now, I don't think we're going to be changing in, 30 years or 40 years fully. We're not going to be rid of fossil fuels per se, but I do hope that we are moving significantly by that time into a carbon-free energy future. And we're talking about something that is huge in terms of scale. You know, exaergs of energy or what have you. Numbers that nobody here can fully appreciate in terms of magnitude.
Okay. Bill?
Yeah, I tend to agree with what Rich said. I mean, one of the questions is, well, how much are we contributing to the CO2 problem individually? And you can actually think about that. Think about your car and how much gasoline you use each week. Think about the size of your gas tank. Imagine all of that turning into carbon as carbon dioxide. So you can kind of get an idea of what your own footprint is. Gasoline is an incredibly valuable material. The energy content is just right for what we want to use as a fuel, as a transportation fuel. You can imagine burning it to warm your house, but we would use other carbon sources for that. But that just gives, you can just put a perspective on that volume or that mass of material each week. That's your personal footprint.
All right, from a listener off air wants to know, wasn't the hydrogen fuel cell industry like a smokescreen funded by big oil or Republicans to show how ultimately all alternative fuel fails? You agree with that?
I disagree with it.
Okay.
I mean, it was, in fact, there was activity many years ago, going back 40 years with regard to solar-driven water splitting into hydrogen and oxygen. And it's important to keep our eyes on the long term, because what happened short term is the funding for that diminished. And then by the time we revved up the funding again for that kind of research, we had lost valuable time in our efforts forward. I would say today that we're much closer to being able to have a viable water splitting system. And again, there are competing ideas and different technologies. One would be to have a direct system that is like the plants, so it's photosynthesis, it's artificial photosynthesis because it's not natural. Another is to take photovoltaic cells that we have and take the electricity from them and use an electrolyzer to split water, and it's a question of how efficient it is. I will say, in addition to the research, there has to be some entrepreneurism with regard to taking something that may be close but suboptimal to market and making that available. So individuals such as Musk are doing a real service in terms of trying to move the goalposts forward.
Okay. Bill?
Yeah. You mentioned the fuel cell, and didn't we already try that and fail? Well, I think what they found is they optimized it, they handed it to the engineers, they did their very best, and what they found is it's expensive. It works fine. It's good enough to put on spacecraft, but it's not good enough to put in your car. It's just too expensive. But that was using the materials from 20 years ago. And one thing that has happened in the past decade or two is there's been a revolution in materials development. And I think that one of the keys to future developments, breakthrough technologies, is going to be in new materials that can do the job that we need to capture sunlight. And again, hydrogen, I think, is the ideal initial fuel, the primary fuel. You can then use that for whatever you want afterwards.
All right, listener named Pablo wants to know, what does Big Oil think of carbon capture? Have they weighed in, and how would they be impacted? No one's here to speak for Big Oil, but have you observed the industry? Are they funding this kind of research, or are they interested?
I don't think they're funding this research. As a matter of fact, the fact that there's just silence when you ask that question tells you what they're doing. I think it's an answer because there is no answer.
Okay.
I don't think they're doing much.
Do you suspect that carbon capture would be something they welcome?
I think that some companies, some industries are going to be pleased to try and do carbon capture and sequestration simply because it helps them longer term maintain what they're doing. And if we are going to go to an environment in which you have credits for CO2 abatement, they could perhaps, and this would be power industry, they would be able to take sequestration as a credit for removing CO2 from the environment. Again, that all, you know, takes the focus away from where we really need to get to.
Sure. Let me get to Steve in Brighton. Go ahead, Steve.
Yes, I have kind of a chemical question. Is anyone working on any process to make the CO2 inert after it's been produced, like some chemical process that you could apply to CO2 to change its chemical makeup to make it less harmful?
I think the answer is yes. And I just was looking on the web before I came in to see what kind of companies are being funded to do just that, to take the CO2 and rather than turn it into a mineral and put it in the ground, what about turning it into a useful chemical? It turns out there's a local company called Novomer. It was started down at Cornell University, but they have research labs even in Rochester, where they're taking carbon dioxide and converting it into a material called a polycarbonate. And this is a type of plastic. So that's an example of taking CO2 and using it for a useful product, a useful material.
Okay. Is it Novomer? That's N-O-V-A-M-E-R-E?
N-O-V-O-M-E-R.
M-E-R. Okay. I'm glad that somebody's working on that.
Let me also say, though, and add that when we talk about how much CO2 is generated in energy-related applications and how much CO2 could be used in chemical materials, new materials, as in these polymers, you're dealing with an order of magnitude difference at least. So 10 times as much CO2 would be generated, 10 times as much carbon would be generated as in the form of CO2 as you would use in the form of CO2 for new materials.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks for the phone call. Next up, Bud in Chile. Go ahead, Bud.
Hi. This is a favorite topic of mine. About 4 years ago, an engineer who worked for me at Kodak came to me with an idea that he'd seen on YouTube, and he had actually constructed a gasoline engine which converted water into hydrogen and oxygen using a bubbler that he put a little bit of gasoline on to start it off, and you pass this heated water vapor through a heat exchanger that uses heat from the exhaust gas of the engine, and it ran beautifully on a lawnmower. And we demonstrated that at MCC and at the U of R. And if anybody wants to see a video of that, they can contact me through the station, and I will be glad to send it to them.
Okay. So, but what's become of it, Bud?
Pardon me?
What's become of it, though?
Both of us are retired. Yeah. We were hoping, I actually have an engine that I'm converting, and I created for the U of R. I have not yet finished it because of other things, but it's 90% there, and if the U of R would grab it, then they can test it and actually find out how efficient it is, what's going into the engine, what the emissions are coming out, and so forth. And I have been working with them on that, but that it has not gone any further than that demonstration at this point.
Hmm. So as a believer in the principle of conservation of energy, I see any claim like this and immediately am highly skeptical. In fact, I would probably reject it out of hand because of the principle of conservation of energy.
I'm a mechanical engineer.
Yeah.
I know the second law of thermodynamics, but there is definite disassociation going on. And so what happens if nothing else? Is it makes more complete combustion of the gasoline that does go in there and utilizes it to convert the water vapor to additional energy.
Hmm.
And it really does work.
Hmm.
And what needs to be done just like I think the other guy says, is more testing has to be done to either prove or debunk the thing. It can't just be left laying there, you know?
Hmm. Well, Bud, thank you. You know, I think Bill's skepticism, Bud says he understands it, but...
You can't get more energy out than you put in. So the amount of gasoline you put in and burn, that's the limit that you're going to get out of that system.
Okay. Bud, thank you for the phone call. Here's Tim on Twitter asking, what about leaves, branches, farm silage? Bury that and it's carbon capture, no?
In a form, it is. It is. Composting is another. But I don't think that we're talking at the scale that you would be able to do for carbon sequestration.
I mean, one place where they are doing something like, well, it's biological, let me put it that way, is they have developed sources or types of algae that are very good at harvesting CO2 and converting it into algal oils. And there are projects aimed at developing farms where you will take the captured CO2, feed it to the algae converts it to an oil that's harvested to make a diesel. So now you have CO2 going back to a carbon-based fuel. It closes the cycle. There's quite a bit of research funded by the Department of Energy on algae and algal oils as a way to capture and reuse CO2.
It's important to remember within that that there is energy that is consumed, and that's sunlight energy.
Okay, here's a longer email from a listener named Dave, but I'm going to read the whole thing here. You can no doubt hear the passion in his email here. He writes, quote, "We scientists have done a poor job explaining the balance that nature has produced. We failed to teach our fellow citizens the truth and the fact that it took nature millions of years to sequester the carbon in our fossil fuels into the earth. That this, this bounty and sink of carbon is now, and has been from the Industrial Revolution, released in such a small time frame, less than 200 years, that our current trouble in our atmosphere in dealing with this historic amount of carbon being released into it is the reason that we are undergoing global warming and climate change. Teaching our fellow citizens that greenhouse processes are one of the reasons that Venus is a dead world today, that we need to avoid the fate of our sister worlds. We must be more concrete in explaining the reasons we must finally stop using fossil fuels, that it is a matter of life and death for our grandchildren. We might caveat this latter notion with the hope that there is still time to avoid such a catastrophe here on our precious planet Earth." That's from Dave. Guys, what do you think?
I happen to agree. I'll applaud with what Dave said. At the same time, not quite so alarmist, but I do think that it is important for us to move away from, you know, from carbon. And I hope that we will be doing that over this century.
Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, Dave's point is a good one, that we've released all this CO2 because we've taken carbon from plants and animals that have been compressed for millions of years, and boom, overnight we release it. Of course there's going to be a big effect on the Earth's climate.
I do think Dave's framing of it that way is a shorter way to explain to folks why, well, maybe this is natural cycles, or maybe this is this or that. If you just say, look, it took millions of years to get this to break down and get in the ground, and we are unleashing it in a very short amount of time. That's why it's not just sort of the simple ebbs and flow of climate over time. And Dave, I do appreciate the email. Thanks very much for that. I want to point out, a listener earlier was asking, you know, sort of the trends and how much fossil fuels we're using. Let me just read some of what producer Megan Mack put together for the show, who does not get nearly enough credit for doing the fabulous job she does every single day for this program. If I ever say anything smart on this program, it's either an accident or Megan's fault. So let me go ahead and just read some of what she collected for us about facts about energy usage and carbon. By the year 2030, our energy demand will have risen by 50% from today alone. Fossil fuels are the main source of current energy consumption, about 80%. And goals set by various places, and you know, you might have seen the Paris climate talks among others, but the goal of reducing cutting expected emissions by 50% over the next 20 years. I mean, that is a huge number. So that's why we're talking about things like carbon capture. That's why we're talking about these ways of mitigating while we are shifting. The IPCC estimates that the economic potential of carbon capture could be between 10 and 55% of the total carbon mitigation effort until the year 2100. So in other words, IPCC sees some potential here if they can get the process working a little better than our guests have described where it currently stands. So down about to our last minute, I'll give you guys both 30 seconds. Bill, what do you want to leave the audience with as we consider this and so many issues related to climate?
So as you just summarized, I think this is a really serious problem that's going to hit us in the face in the next 20 years very hard. We need to take this seriously. We need to do something about it. Unfortunately, people tend not to really react until the problem does hit them in the head. And that may be what's actually going to happen here.
Yeah.
Richard.
I'll say that one of the things that I've had my freshman chemistry students do, they used to calculate, let's say, how much energy comes out of a gram of fuel, whether it's coal or gasoline or methane or hydrogen. And it's instructive how much CO2 comes out. Without any question, hydrogen is the key to the future, even if we use it to take carbon dioxide and reduce it to alcohols, carbohydrates, etc. So we really have to keep our focus that way, and I hope we will.
I think one of the great lessons this hour is whether we're working in mitigation or simply reducing consumption in various ways, we can't take our eyes off of moving to new forms and systems here. That you can do both, but if you do one, you shouldn't abandon the other. So thanks to both of you for being here. Bill Jones, professor of chemistry at the University of Rochester. Great to see you here, Bill. Thank you for being here. And Richard Eisenberg, professor emeritus. Great to see you as well. Thank you. And our thanks to producer Megan Mack and Rob Braden, the engineer, and so many others who contribute to this program. I'm Evan Dawson. Thanks for listening, and we will talk to you on member-supported public radio on a Tuesday.